Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Plus $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Decade Project on One Heat Minute Productions Patreon. I'm, of course, your host, Blake Howard. This is a show where we put a line in the sand and cast our eyes back a decade in the past to see what movies are still hanging around culturally, like what's still significant, what's still making an impact, or most importantly, I guess, what made an influence on movies that we're now seeing, and what's inspiring other filmmakers, or what are other people iterating on and homaging. And so this is a fun show for me to do. I have a fun guest to talk to today again, as usual. We'll get to that in just a moment. But 10 years ago, a little more than 10 years ago, actually, before we get to exactly what we're going to be talking about, the film we're talking about today was based on a book. And I was driving through Africa with my wife on my honeymoon, reading the book by a terrific author, and I was reading it on a bus as we were traveling across the sub-Saharan African continent, and I got to the last line of the book, and I swiftly stood up and frisbeed the book out the window in fury and anger. So I want to thank my friend Courtney Howard, no relation, great writer, part of the LA Film Critics Society, a writer for Variety, AV Club, Fresh Fiction TV, friend of One Heat Minute Productions. Courtney, can you tell the listeners what text could possibly piss me off to the point that I would frisbee the novel out the window? What is it?
Gone Girl. Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl. So my funny story with the book is I was reading it on my 10th anniversary on our trip to Hawaii when we just bought a house. And so I was reading, I was like, oh, what's this about? I hardly ever read. And when I do read, it's always movies that are, or books that are going to be movies.
Yes.
And so I was reading it and sort of filling in my husband each day on like what was going on in the book. And he was like, there's a turning point in the book. I mean, we can talk about spoilers. It's been around.
We're spoiling this to hell. It has not only been, Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl. Before we get to David Fincher's Gone Girl, Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl was a smash. It was
huge.
A smash. I saw countless people reading it. I think I did the same thing as you, was like, yeah, one of my favorite filmmakers is going to be making a movie about this. Why not? When I go away and I travel, particularly pre-children, which is now a factor, I voraciously read, and I particularly like crime books or pulpy novels. I love them. So for me, I went and I think I just went into the airport and I grabbed an extra of like 5 books to chuck in my backpack, and this was one of them. But so it's a smash. We can spoil the living daylights out of it.
In the book, there's different, it balances like different perspectives. There's Nick's perspective, there's Amy's perspective, and you sort of have to piece together what's the truth. And there's a huge turn with Nick in the book where he's like, all right, you guys aren't going to like me for this. This is what I've been dreading. In the book, you hear the narration in the head. And we'll get to it when we talk about the movie, but the movie was so adapting this book. I was like, I don't know how they're going to adapt this into a movie, because in the wrong hands, it's going to be really lazy and cliched, and they're not going to be able to do this balance of perspective things. Like, how are they going to do that? And somehow they solved that. And it, for me, it turned into a brilliant film. But I read up to the turn, and I was telling my husband about the turn, and he's like, oh, okay, stop. I'm gonna read this. So then it got to the big reveal with Amy, and he was like, okay, I'm really gonna read this. So don't tell me anymore. So every day I was like reading chapters and chapters, and I'm like, holy shit, like just screaming. And then the end happens, and I was like, oh my God. I was like, you have to read this. You have to start reading this now. And so it's like towards the end of our vacation, friends of ours have also read this too. And so we were like, we're going to do a book club. So we did a book club on it. It was a whole thing. Like, I mean, this book was huge. And then we were all like eagerly awaiting the movie. We were trying to like, one of my friends, Jermaine, he now writes for IO9. He was writing for Slash Film at the time. He was trying to orchestrate, like we were joking, like, let's try to orchestrate something since, you know, we're both bloggers or whatever. We're both reporters. We can like, let's talk to Fox about doing something with this. And like, I mean, we couldn't get anything going because they already have their marketing scheme like pre-planned. And their marketing scheme was brilliant on this movie. Like they had character posters, their character teaser posters were like significant props from the book. So like the X-Acto knife, the red panties, a clue letter, a picture of their wedding.
There was nothing better in the marketing for this movie. So let's quickly, because we've been talking so much about the book, we've got to get to Gillian Flynn.
Brilliant.
Great writer. Adapts her own screenplay, which is no mean feat, especially because you so have to kill your darlings or accept what the balance of how this is going to be approached. Fincher, of course, loves these little pervy, insidious texts and very attracted to it, you can see. The film stars Ben Affleck on an upswing.
Yeah.
Post Argo, and he's done Gone Baby Gone. He's done he's done The Town, which may be my favorite Ben Affleck movie. He then does Argo, Oscars galore, does Batman v Superman. He's on the upswing. Rosamund Pike, sort of fresh, like for American audiences off like Jack Reacher. That was the kind of only other big thing in the last couple of years that she'd done. And she rolls into this, stars a whole other wonderfully eclectic cast, including Carrie Coon, Neil Patrick Harris, Tyler Perry, Kim Dickens, you name it, right? Great people. But Ben Affleck with that shit-eating Nick grin, it's his whole personality. Like he's so perfectly cast, and Rosamund is really sensational as Amy. And like, yeah. I think what has stood the test of time so much is that they, at this particular point in their lives, were so perfectly cast for this. That was so amazing, and they laid such an amazing platform. And Fincher had a great relationship with Ben, and so like, and they worked really well together as with Rosamund. But then I just now, you know, I think about the reaction at the time, and I think about Affleck being on a high at the time, and then I also think at the time, Rosamund Pike was a like a revelation for people, and I think that that's if we're looking back at that time. There's a couple of those, like, this person's a revelation. And I do definitely remember at the time people going, oh my God, Tyler Perry was in a real movie. Like, like, I mean, he is like a multi-bajillionaire right now. So like everyone else has egg on their face because he's building film studios and other people can't even get into a film anymore. But like, I remember at the time people were like, oh my God, Tyler Perry is like legitimized. He's working with David Fincher. God, he might get an Academy Award nomination. So like, there was a lot of chatter about this. Lots of people saw the movie. I can't believe in a way that the movie had such a wide appeal that then got people to go back to the book. And I also was never expecting that now when we run 10 years later, that it has such an impact. So what was, like, you're obviously based in the US. What was the fever pitch at the time? What was the community reaction to this movie critically at the time? Like, when it first came out, did you have a pulse check on that?
Sort of. I mean, there are people who really did not care for the book. They thought it was just, you know, basic pulp. They didn't really see it for what I think it is absolutely brilliant in terms of nailing marital relationships, of course, on a heightened scale. And like, nobody's as big as a psychopath as Amazing Amy, but like sort of getting a relationship dynamic, the revenge like core of this movie is so visceral. The movie is actually really, really funny too, like darkly funny. It has that dark, dark comedy that Fincher likes to like incorporate into his films. I think this is probably his like funniest movie in a while. At the time it was, at least. And I don't think
you're wrong. When you just said that, it just took me a second to register. I'm like, yeah, absolutely. Because people love, and I've even watched this along with my best mate, Maria. It's a movie that you laugh to, but like the book, I remember being mad.
Yeah.
I was blood red mad because I was like, oh my God, like the idea of this, how this evil. It was
I don't know how people who didn't read the book react to this. Like, I think, you know, my friend Fred is always sort of my litmus test sometimes of like, did you like this? Did you not? He's my first go-to of like, what did you think? He did not read the book. And I think he still really loved the movie too. Maybe not to the degree I hold it dear, near and dear to my heart, but like, I think he liked it and he was able to understand it. And other people, other critics I know also read the book. So a lot of us sort of came into it having read the books. Now, some didn't. And some, you know, I think the reviews were kind of spotty. I haven't checked Rotten Tomatoes.
It got 88%. I think there been a lot. There has been a lot of more recent, like, reflective reviews that have come over the top.
Yeah, probably. Because more people are able to add their stuff to more accepted.
Yeah, so they're adding stuff a little bit later, but like, it's pretty damn positive. Like Mark Kermode, he's just like, at 149 minutes, the film never drags nor does its mood settle, slipping from classy narcissistic humor to exploitation inflected thrills in an instant, mercurial, mystifying, and tantalizingly missing. So good. Like, great review. Alfonso Duralde was like, just thoroughly engrossing, even when it stops being logical. I think that was about the softest one there. You know, there's Wesley Morris just said it's a sick movie. And he just said it was a bit lumbering and anti-imaginative, which, okay, fair, you know, like anyone's impression but like overall, it just keeps saying like, it's good, it's good, it's good, it's good, it's good.
It mainly got a lot of chatter from like, oh, like, I think they started to lean into a like, oh, it's a perfect date night movie, like a little, you know, sort of poking the bear sort of thing. And like, I'm sure there were people who had their first dates to this movie. I don't know what the conversation
was. What
was
your first date movie with hubby?
Our first date movie? Oh my God. Boogie Nights.
Sensational. Mine with my
Can't
lovely
start
wife.
A relationship better than that.
Mine was Blue Valentine.
God,
I'm not joking.
Oh my God,
I'm not joking.
That's another one of my favorite, because my whole shtick, and Blake knows this, and this is why he had me on Heat, is I love a good relationship drama.
Yes.
So a good marital strife movie. So like, that's one of my favorite.
One of the happiest, happily married people I know is like, what I want is marital strife where lives get destroyed. That's exactly my bag for this. I'm in the
husband is like, should I be worried? And I was like, no, if anything, it just makes you appreciate what you have.
Exactly. Exactly.
Hey, I'm not but acting out. I'm not being a psychopath, but I do like to joke with him whenever he walks in on me watching this movie that I'm taking. I like to say, I'm taking notes.
Yeah, I'm taking notes. I'm writing in my diary, in inverted commas, in different pens, and it will be burned or semi-burned in some kind of weird incinerator.
And the other thing that got a lot of print, too, with this was Ben Affleck showing his peen.
Mm, yep.
That was a big deal.
Side dick, just like side boob.
He just glides right over, and everybody was like at least I was. There's like mazel tov, Jennifer. And what's funny is when we're talking about Ben Affleck, like this is pre his Phoenix tattoo.
Yeah.
This is like a year, or maybe it was 8 months. I think I researched this. I did the math. I think it was like 8 months or something before he actually ended his marriage with Jennifer Garner.
Yeah.
So I think that's interesting, an interesting sort of subtext. But I think that's pretty daring to do a sort of anti-marriage movie when yours is sort of on this, you know, tenuous brink.
But I think that that's Fincher's perverted thing. He's like, this guy is a circus.
Yeah.
And he's probably unfairly a circus. Mm-hmm. And the more that you see him as an older man, sober now, just with his shit together, very mm-hmm. cogent, he's a really intelligent Academy Award, multiple Academy Award winning mm-hmm. filmmaker who I genuinely think has made some terrific films as a director, like a phenomenal mm-hmm. films. And yeah. I'm way more a bigger fan of his deployment, his autobiography. It's like his auto deployment of himself and his skills seem so much like all the way from Good Will Hunting as a screenwriter and actor. For me, he always feels so much better and knows how to use himself in the stuff that he produces. Even Air, he's hilarious. Like Air, he's just fun, just sitting behind a desk with stupid sunglasses on and like tracksuits, 80s tracksuits. It's like the best. It's, you know, there's something about that. But what I think here in Gone Girl for Affleck is, like, Fincher saw a circus of expectation of this guy and is like, this is just gonna be like adding steroids to this character because people are gonna bring all these preconceived he's a shit notions to him and to Nick, and it's gonna be like a cocktail that spikes that you don't even realize how potent it is. So
And he's so good in this movie. He is so, this is one of my favorite Ben Affleck performances.
He's great.
Yeah. It's an all-timer for him. He's so charming. He's so smarmy. He's so like dopey. He's like smart. And he's just really so, it's such a finely tuned performance from both of them. And to have that chemistry where they both have to like, you know, to put it crassly, they're either fucking or fighting. So like to have that sort of chemistry to do both and so brilliantly and never break the spell is just, I mean, they're both just incredible actors. And like you were saying, all the supporting actors are incredible. Like Tyler Perry is like exactly how the book described. I think the book said Alec Baldwin or something, but like, he's so perfect as the sort of smarmy, let's dazzle the media. Let's do the razzle dazzle.
I don't want to run. We have to pump the brakes on Tyler because I think there's so much that I want to talk to you about Tyler. But I just really quickly want to acknowledge Rosamund Pike is so fucking good in this movie.
Oh my God!
And Fincher back to back, you know, in a weird kind of Alan Pakula way, made Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the American adaptation, which Rooney Mara was sensational in and was nominated for an Academy Award and then lost. And I'm trying to find out who the hell Rosamund Pike lost to as a 2015 Academy Award nominee. Mm. So.
And I don't remember.
I'm just going down here. Oh, God. Oof, this is a toughie.
I think it was a hard year too, if I remember correctly.
It's sort of three-fifths of a hard year.
Oh no.
In 2015, the Oscars for this, for 2014 movies, nominated was Reese Witherspoon in Wild. terrific performance, actually one of her best.
Yeah.
Nominated Marianne Cotillard for 2 Days, One Night, which if you have never seen that movie,
great.
Seek it out. Mm-hmm. Absolutely sensational.
Mm-hmm.
Also nominated, as you know, our girl, Rosamund Pike.
Mm-hmm. Now, Uh-oh. I'm worried, Blake.
Felicity Jones was also nominated for The Theory of Everything, which all the respect in the world.
That movie's, not her best work.
Movie's garbage, and she does.
Yes.
She matches the level of the text that she's working with.
That's a nicely way to put it. I like that diplomatic way to put it.
That's, yeah, she matches the text. She doesn't elevate. She just matches the quality of the text. And in perhaps the most forgettable performance of her entire career, Julianne Moore won for Still Alice.
Oh, right. Yes, the Still Alice year. I was pissed. I think I blocked that from my memory because I was so angry, because that is not her best work at all.
Now, if you just
look... that movie was so cloying.
Now, also, the best performance by an actor in a leading role that year, Steve Carell for Foxcatcher, a haunting, chilling, crazy performance.
Mm-hmm.
Keaton, my man, Michael damn Keaton. My son's name is Keaton.
Aww.
For Birdman, which a lot of people like weird feelings about, but I think the thing that is undeniable is he's great in it. Whatever you think about that movie, he's fantastic in it.
Correct.
Benedict Cumberbatch in The Imitation Game is the perfect match of text and actor.
Mm-hmm.
Terrific movie. Got a lot of love for it. Then you've got, it's the same, it's the 3/5 rule in the best performance by an actor in a leading role. Then you've got Bradley Cooper in American Sniper, which is like the popular vote movie of the year, right? It was huge. American Sniper is undeniably a monster.
Yeah.
But the winner, Edward Redmayne, for The Theory of Everything. Again, the...
What?
One of the worst movies I've ever seen.
I remember going into that movie thinking, because they were so pushy about the love story. It's a love story. And then, like, spoilers for Theory of Everything, he, like, cheats on her. And I was like, well, now what's the story? And there is no, like, it's just this genius guy. And I was like, what is the story? Like, this is garbage. I don't like this. This is not good.
It's also a weird year. There's lots of weird stuff, but it, mm-hmm. This is one of the first times on the, you know, the Decade Project for 2014 that I'm at, you know, in 24, that I'm mm-hmm. like looking back, really, because there's a lot of Oscar stuff that came up, you know, Richard Linklater doesn't win for direction and Boyhood. I mean, Morten Tilden does a phenomenal job of The Imitation Game. Love that. Wes Anderson nominated for Grand Budapest. Amazing. Bennett Miller, Foxcatcher. It's not Bennett Miller's best movie, but I totally get that he'd kind of mm-hmm. the groundswell of him. Inarritu wins for Birdman. But I can say, like, we much love for everything. I don't know how I would cram Tyler Perry into this best actor by in a supporting role, except to kick out Edward Norton. Much love to Edward Norton. But, like... Or Robert Duvall, but this is the best actor by a supporting actor. Mm-hmm. It's Ethan Hawke in Boyhood, Mark Ruffalo in Foxcatcher, both all-timer performances on their collective resumes. Robert Duvall's in The Judge, which I love that movie unashamedly.
My husband loves it too.
Yeah. Maybe it's just a guy with dad issues movie. So yeah, welcome to the club. Hey. But J.K. Simmons wins for Whiplash, which is extremely deserving. And Patricia Arquette wins for Boyhood, which is like huge, you know, other great performances in that year, but phenomenal. But I just remember how diabolical the thought that Julianne Moore was better, like pound for pound better or more memorable than Gone Girl. And I think that that's going to lead us perfectly into the next thing I want to talk about. It's like 10 years later, this movie is memed within an inch of its life.
Mm-hmm.
People are talking about, like, I love the exploitative, like, side dick view rather than, you know, Rosamund Pike getting the amazing Amy's out. Like, it's got it, like, there's so much stuff that this movie has now, like, gone crazy with. It's like the whole jokes about Affleck getting Fincher to cast Emily Ratajkowski, and it's like, oh yeah, we need the hot girl, and he's like, yeah, let's get this girl, and it's like this hilarious thing of like, oh my god, no wonder your marriage ended. Like, this is just the worst. It's
and he infantilizes her.
Yes.
So much as a person, like his character does. He's like the way he dresses her is like he's dressing a child.
Yes.
Like it's just so, like, that was the thing that stood out to me on this like 100th watch of this movie.
But that's what I'm saying. It's like in 10 years, people have obsessively watched mm-hmm. this movie, and Fincher, I mean, Courtney, you know, I am a fan of Fincher, especially Zodiac. It's a source of deep, great source of inspiration and obsession. And the thing that infuriates me to death is the relitigation of the film, a filmmaker's resume every time that their new movie comes out. And mm-hmm. Fincher gets it, Mann gets it, Soderbergh mm-hmm. gets it. Oh my God. And he makes so many movies, which makes it even more infuriating. And it's just like, I hate this relitigation. However, I do like a collective ongoing groundswell of appreciation for the underappreciated, or those ones that sometimes when the films are relitigated in the rankings, people are like, no, actually,
mm-hmm.
Gone Girl may be his best film. And I just, that would never, if you had said years ago when he was adapting this, that some people are like, oh, it's one of his best, or it's, oh, no, it's Zodiac, oh, no, it's Seven, you totally get it, Fight Club, oh, it's this, you know, like people are bounce around. But how well this movie has aged, and how fastidiously it's put together, and how just rich as a text it is, with all the weird eclectic actors that are in it, with everything. I think that that's one of the big things in 10 years, that like there was never a doubt in this year that I would not cover Gone Girl. Like that was like maybe the second movie I wrote down on the list that had to be covered. Cause it's, and I think that if you said now, if people relitigated and they went back and they did the Oscars again, there's no way that Rosamund Pike doesn't win.
Right.
And Affleck might have been nominated in the actors. You know, you never know. And Tyler Perry might have been in the supportings. Like, it's such a crazy thing that this movie, this dark, twisted, perverse, like, tormented little movie is so rewatchable.
And people still get, like, I mean, I've always believed, and, you know, it's manifested over the years. Like, I had floated on Twitter that I think that, you know, it's my theory that, and I'd love to talk to Gillian Flynn about it, and or Fincher, if he would like to call me at any point and just say, hey, let's talk about Gone Girl or Fight Club or Seven. Let's do this. Like, I would love to talk about, like, how, for as much as Amazing Amy thinks that they are above everybody else, like in a snooty way, like they're not going to be like every other couple who does all this mundane shit and fights over stupid things and does all this things. But she has a very rudimentary, very mundane breakup. And she spirals like any normal human woman would, where she is, you know, eating junk food. She's getting away. She's doing a makeover, even though she's looking uglier. Like, she is just retreating into herself. She's pissed off. She's in full revenge mode. And of course, like, when you do get broken up with, as I'm sure everybody has, like, they instantly retreat to comfort food. They instantly retreat to, like, I want to get away from this person. I want to make this person's life miserable. But, you know, obviously we can't do it to the vicious degree that Amy, the maniacal, narcissistic degree that Amy does it. But she has a very sort of normal breakup. And everybody, like, when I floated this on Twitter, everybody, like a bunch of men, decided to yell at me and be like, no, she's just disguising herself. And I was like, when has a woman's thing, like when she has said something, has it only been just that one thing? Like, there's always something, Courtney, underneath that iceberg.
Courtney, I, even as an observer of women on social media who totally live a completely different existence to me, mm-hmm. I say batshit things often.
Yeah.
Quite antagonistic things. I don't get many responses. You say the most normal shit I've ever seen sometimes. Mm-hmm. I actually really relish the opportunity to read what your new takes on flicks are. And people like sometimes just go nuts. And I'm like, okay, no, it's just the life of a woman on the internet. But I agree. That's what's so fantastic because it is. I think it has like a weird, beautiful symmetry to either to both kinds of the breakup. And in the book, it's a little bit more pronounced because you kind of get the kind of weird, perverted stuff that Desi's already a weird unit of a guy. But yeah. In the book, it's like she's purposely eating herself to have the disguise. Yes. But what is good about it is like, oh, that's a breakup reason. You know, that's someone eating, that's someone changing their look. And then she does the reverse. She does the glow up, which is like she gets with Desi. And if you've read the book, he's like, you know, there's a treadmill in your room and you're going to eat right. And the subtlety in that is to make, I think, to emphasize just how completely screwed up she is because this poor guy's a little bit more innocent. But in the book, it plays with that kind of twisty. They only just hint at it in the movie. I think it's really one of the aspects why it ages well is she then glows up.
Yeah.
She cuts her hair.
She has this like hold over him
yes.
where she's like, I need to be punished. And like, yeah. She does it so knowingly yes. that's his kink.
Yeah.
And like, so she knows how to control these people. Like she's not a stupid woman. Like she's in full control really at all times, but Nick makes her spiral out of control. And that's why that's the root of revenge. She never thought because she's so narcissistic, she never thought he would ever lose
cheat
her.
On her.
Cheat on her, nothing. And then when she sees that sort of happening and he does the move, which that I believe actually happened. Like she's an unreliable narrator for a lot of
Completely,
this.
Completely, yeah.
You can see where reality and sort of fiction sort of blur. But that's a moment where I think she's fully vulnerable and she doesn't like that. And that is not her thing. And she's like, fuck you, Nick. You've done this to me. Like, no way, baby. You're not going off with another bouncy or cool girl. Like, no. I'm that cool girl.
She has the meanest. She's like, with the giant come on me tits. Like, she just is so, she's mean about poor Emily Ratajkowski.
Why does she look like a Mennonite?
Yeah.
Funniest line. I tell you, this movie is hilarious.
So many great lines in this movie. But I want to circle back because we're talking about yes. Tyler Perry before.
Yes.
This particular time I was watching it and I find this that happens with me. And I know you're a bit like this because I read your stuff and I watch carefully on your socials, your reactions to things. There's kind of different layers of viewing something. You're watching it for the first time. You're just trying to get a handle on what it is. You watch it the second time. You can sort of sit and dwell a bit, be a bit more comfortable with the pace. And, you know, you kind of know how the movie's taught you how it wants you to watch it. But as you watch a movie over and over again, you find yourself like, okay, I know who the lead performers are. And I know the mercurial structure of the, like the technical qualities of the movie, the intercuts, the interstitials, the sort of languid looks, the pace, all those different things, and Fincher is so fastidious with camera moves and music and tone. But then I love staring into the chorus, right, of all of these great actors. And this time for me, holy heck, did Carrie Coon and Tyler Perry just blow out of the screen. I was just like, Carrie Coon is fantastic as Margot, and Tyler Perry is just delicious as Tanner Bolt. He is so great, such a slimy bastard, relishes and laughs at the most tormented shit in this movie. And he's like, you guys are fucked up. He just laughs. Yeah. Like he's like, yeah, I'm going to make money off you. This is great. This is great for me. This is going to be fantastic. It is just that. And even then down the line, like Patrick Fugit and Kim Dickens, mm-hmm. Kim Dickens, who I absolutely adore. Deadwood's one of my favorite shows. And so anytime I got to see Joni Stubbs do anything else, I was very excited. But it's then you got Casey Wilson, who's in Happy Endings, is fantastic as Noelle Hawthorne, Boyd Holbrook and Lola Kirk, the kind of shitbag couple of Jeff and Greta, who Amy meets when she's on the lam in Missouri, etc. Like all of that. There's just so many people. Cela Ward is fantastic. Another cop, Lee Norris. Like, there's all these sensational little like flourishes from all these great actors that are in the background that you just go, wow, like they, like every person is cast to perfection and just crushes.
And the gal who played Amy's mom, we did sort of a deep dig because we also watched, this is going to be such a weird relation, Cocktail. She's in Cocktail as Bonnie, the woman who takes Tom Cruise's character back as like her boy toy to New York. And we were doing a deep dig on her. She actually passed away in 2021. Yeah. I don't want to bring down the room, but she passed away in 2021 when she got hit by an electric scooter in New York City. So like she's 65. She had done stuff with like Gore Verbinski too after Gone Girl. She was such a great performer and great actress. And so I was like, oh, wow. Like, I mean, top to bottom, like even Amy's dad is fantastic too. There's not a weak link in this cast. No. And you would think that Tyler Perry is going to be the weak link because all of his work, you know, sort of like, even though he's a very dedicated man and he gives opportunities to a lot of actresses who have been written off and sort of undermined and so underestimated, like his work here, he really brought his A game. And it's so amazing to see him like apply himself and like, you know, he made a conscious effort to like, I think he lobbied for this role and he made a conscious effort to sort of raise his game for this role. And he did so magnificently, like, and it's like you said, it's aged so well with all of the performances. Carrie Coon is so amazing. She gets so many funny lines in this and she's like, they don't look like twins at all. Of course, they're fraternal, but like you can see their interplay is so perfectly meshed, hers and Ben Affleck's. And Kim Dickens is so great. Like they're once a month, I think of her and Patrick Fugit's like sort of conversation where he was like, well, my girlfriend thinks that Nick is guilty. And she goes, well, if Tiffany says. Like, I think of that so often because it's so condescending, but it's so perfect and right on. Just the dialogue delivery is just fantastic all around. And of course, we know Fincher is meticulous about this. They probably did 70, 80 takes and more power to him. If that's what it takes to get what he wants, then that's great. You got to find your actors who are willing to give you that. And it's such a blessing that he was able to assemble this ensemble who was able to sort of rise to that challenge. And it really shows, like, you know,
I just want to ask an unanswerable question.
Yeah.
How many side dick shots, right? How many times did Affleck get in that shower? Like how many times did he undress and redress Emily Ratajkowski? It's probably the fastest amount of takes of all of the movies. It was like,
I would think so.
He probably wouldn't have let Affleck have that much fun on set with Emily Ratajkowski. Like he was just like, nah, man, you take it off, you put it back on. That's one take's enough. You know, we're good. Yeah. And he's like, come on, man, we did 30 takes of me putting down a pen. Can't you do this again? It's like, no. But yeah, this time around, you know, Tyler Perry, and it's kind of like, I think about it, you know, in Australia, it's as an outsider, I sort of equate Tyler Perry in a weird way to like country music, which is like, I'm not really familiar with it. I don't hate country music, but like there's no huge country music radio station that I have to listen to. You know, we've got Spotify, we've got podcasting apps. You just listen to whatever the hell you want. It's a detached thing, but it's so massive. Like you see people go to these concerts for these huge country music stars. Like I think Luke Combs, like, is a perfect recent example where like started seeing all these socials of like hundreds of thousands of people in Australia go and see his shows. And it's just like, huh? I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I didn't know he was so goddamn ginormous in this country. And I think of that with Tyler Perry, cause he's got this very specific niche mm-hmm. and a very loyal and voracious consumer group.
Mm-hmm.
And they just like these dopey movies that he makes much kind of like, they're like kind of like, even dopier than the dopiest of like the Adam Sandler kind of comedies. And he just has, and all these like weird derivations now, TV series, et cetera, that sit on all these different networks. And, but him just as an actor and a persona and a charmer, I guess the trinity of like Tanner Bolt, Tyler Perry, Margot Dunn, and then Kim Dickens as Detective Rhonda Boney, who I, you know, there's all those jokes like True Detective season whatever, but like the True Detective Kim Dickens and Patrick Fugit, like that's True Detective. Like she's so sensational as Bonnie, like just like spotting things, post-it notes, rationale. Mm-hmm. Like she's such a great detective, and I think that's also what makes this. It's just like that as the movie goes on, and it becomes more and more obvious that like she's completely aware that Amy is a psychopath. I love their interplay. They've only got like a couple of scenes where they're very close to each other, but that in the hospital, it's like 20 out of 10.
She's like, now back to this. But then the whole, it's one of those, like, you look around and it's a whole fleet of men that Amy is dazzling and putting on this show for. And they're like, no, let's let her talk. Like she's playing that role that she knows these men want to see her in, is this like, oh, this victim role. But then Kim Dickens is not buying it at all. Bonnie is not buying it at all. She's like, now back to this. Like, let's go back. This doesn't, you know, it doesn't sit right. And then when it cuts back even further to like Patrick Fugit and Nick and Ben Affleck in the sort of side room, and Ben Affleck's like, oh, you know, that's pretty convenient. And Patrick Fugit's like, can't you just be happy your wife's home? It's just so funny.
So it's been 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I've been trying to find if really there was anyone else to be these specific roles. So in 2012, Reese Witherspoon's company bought the rights to this, as she has done with so many things, and turned, you know, she's become kind of mini mogul herself, which is great. And it says here, believe what you want on the sort of like IMDb trivia of it all, is that once she met Fincher, who when he was interested, she was like, this is going to be fantastic. Once she met and sort of saw the vision for what the movie was, she said as a producer that she's just sort of withdrew herself from contention, was like, okay, I don't think I'm right for this.
Mm-hmm.
Affleck seems to have been the guy to play Nick right from the outset. And that was never in contention. Like that casting seemed to be like fit for purpose.
Yeah.
But Rosamund Pike as Amy, the only thing was like she was 35, and that like he said she could pass for older or younger because she was just, you know, she's got that kind of glacial beauty.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to see, I haven't been able to find, like, was there anyone else that was seriously in contention for this? I don't think there was.
Yeah, I don't remember hearing anything that anybody else was supposed to be, you know, anybody else. I do remember reading that about Reese Witherspoon saying that, or it just being a story in the press. They didn't do, like, this premiered, I think, at New York Film Festival, and they didn't do a whole ton of press. They did like select press here and there for the movie, but I don't remember it ever getting asked, like, was there ever anybody else for these roles? They just, I don't know, maybe down the line, maybe at some other random Q&A in 20 years, we'll finally get that
See if
answer.
There was someone else, yeah.
But they all seem so perfect and tailor fit for those roles. And they have, you know, Fincher always has just brilliant casting directors, you know, casting these things. But it would be interesting to hear who else was up for these parts. But it just feels so tailor-made for, like, Ben, shit-eating grin.
Oh, absolutely. Now, the big one is, also we haven't mentioned, is Neil Patrick Harris, who at the time...
Oh, right.
Was like gigantic on How I Met Your Mother, as this around time he's like hosting Tonys and Oscars and things like that. And he comes into play what is just kind of like an icky role for Fincher.
Yeah, he's pretentious. Scrabble and Octopus.
Scrabble and Octopus and
Like,
you can talk about, you can talk about paintings.
Yeah.
Talk about paintings.
He's the anti, like, he's the guy that, like, Amy thought she wanted, but then was like, no, I do not. Like, this is the guy who I'm sure her parents would have liked her to go with, like, in life, or maybe, like, he's above. He's, you know, just as, you know, narcissistic and pretentious as she thinks she is. But then she chose a regular guy to sort
to
of
worship her. Yeah.
To worship her and to sort of remake and rehab. And like she says in her whole, you know, monologue, like, he gave her things that, you know, Nick gave her things that she never dreamed of, like teased out, you know, a vulnerability.
Yeah, we saw it. We saw it in the show.
Yeah. And so, and then she thinks that she made him a better person, but she couldn't really do that with Desi because he was already like the extreme version of, like, you know, just, I don't know. Just he's on another level.
He absolutely is. And the other person who, again, in so many of these things, like 10 years later, what's stuck around? Well, this movie's definitely stuck around, and Fincher's still making movies and is still a great topic of fascination. I do miss a Fincher movie opening in a theater, like having a theatrical release, for God's sake. But Scoot McNairy is another one that pops up in this movie whose cameo is so sensational because it is the kind of, you know, I think also in so many of the heightened things that this movie does, and you mentioned it really early, which is that, you know, the eating and the gaining weight and then the glow up and those things are very relatable, genuine relationship things, but they're also then fused with this kind of crazy revenge, psychopathy, you know, obsession, all that sort of stuff. But it's also, you know, there are times when, you know, you could balls up a relationship. You could totally be the bad person who ends a relationship badly. And sometimes you might meet a, you know, your ex's ex or someone who knows them. And they're like, no, it probably wasn't as clean cut as you were just the asshole. Mm-hmm. Like, someone can give you that sanity check of like, no, that person wasn't great. And you probably did something stupid because you weren't brave or you were a bit cowardly and things happen and things are bad. And I've always found that such a fascinating thing because he kind of pops in and he's like, no, I was not interested anymore. She like messed me up. Like, and it was like, I was the road test for what you're going through. And I think it's such a great character because it's like, oh no, like there's one other person that this has happened to who Amy has dismantled their life just because they didn't like her anymore. And then this all happened. And it's like, I think it's such a powerful, it's like you said, unreliable versus reliable. It's a reliable moment in a wholly unreliable film that I think it just works to perfection. And Scoot is so fantastic in that scene. Cause like, oh yeah, I'll fucking tell you everything. I'll tell you, you know, it's going to be tough to hear, but like it's already happened to me. So I may as well just tell you the truth. And he feels so reliable in that moment.
Yeah. And if anyone like had auditioned to be a Nick, Scoot McNairy would have been a pretty great Nick, but it's great because you can see he was the stepping stone to what Nick became.
Yes.
Like you were saying. And like, he's like, oh, so you do know your wife. And they have sort of like their conversation together. They both have a sort of same cadence, like a similar cadence. They also have a similar look. He was the project before, he was the test starter project. So you could sort of see that in his like body language and sort of dress and mannerisms and stuff. Like, it's pretty incredible. Yeah, he comes in and he just like reveal, like there's a real genuine character reveal there of like, this is what your wife is, like she's a sociopath.
I also really
any
love
of my ex-boyfriends ever came to my husband and been like, your wife's a sociopath. Maybe.
I shudder to think what an ex talking to my current wife would be like.
But these are the conversations that, you know, this is why this movie lasts for so long, is there's so many conversations to have about it. Like, not just like, you know, like you were saying, Fincher has his definite like technical mastery of, you know, the below the line stuff. Like, I think Kirk Baxter's work in this editing is incredible, because he like constantly is keeping the narrative and the character and the momentum. And I'm sure that's Fincher, probably, you know, a collaborative effort. Like, the way that the tones come in and out, the perspectives, like, it has a lot to sort of like, it has a lot going on in this. And so to be able to like just balance all of this, like, and just make it last. And then you see references to other films, like when they're in the elevator, like that's very Fatal Attraction to me. Yeah. They don't have sex in the elevator, but it's very a Fatal Attraction-y thing. And then like, you know, Nick going down on Amy, like that wasn't that, you know, cunnilingus was not a huge deal on movie screens and like major motion pictures. So it's like, that's the thing where I was like, I like him. Like, good for him. Good for him. He's showing it. He's showing
the game. He's got game.
He's got game. He's got game. So like, that was a big deal. So like, there's a lot of things in here that sort of like, you know, it's watertight and it still holds true. Like, what's there, the sentiments that are there are still true 10 years later. It's timeless, I think. And even its commentary on the media, like, it's still the exact same thing. You can still absolutely snow the media and twist it to the way you want it to be and twist the narrative to the way you want it to be.
Because if the media likes the narrative, they just, they
Miracle
see where
on the Mississippi.
They it's flawless, right? It's that, it's that whole thing. And like, Tanner Bolt's great because like, he knows when it turns around. Mm-hmm. Oh, if I just say this cute alliterative name, everyone's going to take that and run with it. You know, like he's that's what's so brilliant about Tyler Perry in this too. The one funny last thing is, in the last 10 years, the omnipresence of like reels or like YouTube stories videos has had some great clips. And one of them is a Matt Damon clip. I think it's from, maybe it's from an interview that he did with The Ringer with Bill Simmons or something like that. But he's talking about like, who's the, you know, he hasn't worked with Fincher, but he went to set and watched Ben and Rosamund do a take.
Oh.
And in this story, he tells that it's a story when they're in the bookstore, when they're just walking down an aisle. It's before they shag in the bookstore. Mm-hmm. And they're walking down the aisle and they're giving this great performance. And he said he was watching his buddy like deliver this great performance. And Rosamund, who he had only just met, was like delivering, crushing this performance. He's sitting in Video Village with Fincher, and someone, a background actor, walks in the back of the scene as part of just the like thing. And that he walks in the scene and he goes, and Fincher just in the middle of the take while they're performing, just starts going, who the fuck walks like that? And it's like, who the fuck walks like that? And so he knows that the take's ruined. Yeah. Right? He knows that Fincher's never going to use it. It's someone walking in the background for like a half second. He's like, why is he walking like that? And then they do the take again, and Matt's sitting there, and then like the script girl comes over to talk to someone or to like take a note of where they got up to or whatever. And then she walks in the frame because it's cut. They've called cut on the scene. Like, so they're resetting. And she walks and he goes, see, that's how you fucking walk. Like, see, look, that's how you walk. Like, that's a person who's walking like an all. Like, what the fuck is that person doing? And he's like, he observed that, like, I've never seen someone like be so fastidious about every aspect of the frame that like some small thing, even though the performance, which is the focal point of the frame, is so key and is so crackling and it's on point and they're charming the pants off of each other, it's that. And so I think that, yeah, like you said right at the beginning, and like I have come to learn and appreciate about Fincher, is like, he has one shot with every movie that he does, and if he needs 100 takes to make it perfect, that's why his movies stand up to scrutiny over many, many years and rewatches, even if movies don't necessarily resonate with you. And I would say this, like his most recent movie, which came out in 2023, The Killer, I know a lot of folks had a really great time with it. I saw it in a theater. I was lucky enough in Australia, they had a, like a very limited theatrical release. I saw it in the theater rather than on Netflix, which is great. It's not a movie that hit me. Like, it kind of bounced off me. It was like a you know, I slipped the punch, I suppose you would call it. Like, it just kind of glided off my chin. I was like, oh, that, I mean, yeah, it was a movie, and I, there's definitely things I can appreciate about it, but it didn't jive with me. Like, there was electricity in the movie, and it was in the form of Tilda Swinton. And she gave the movie a jolt of electricity that I was waiting for. But that being said, it's a movie that it bounced off me. I didn't think much about it for long afterwards, but now that I like am on Netflix at home late at night sometimes, I find myself constantly wanting to like, should I run that back? Like, did I miss something? And I feel like that's the thing after 10 years. It's like Gone Girl was an immediate, like, it was a really enjoyable, I enjoyed it more than the book. I suppose the book helped me. Like, the book is an infuriating thing because it's just like, how badly can people hurt each other? It's awful. And I was actually on my honeymoon at the time that I read the book, and I was like, I don't want any part of this. Like, I don't want to watch, you know, a marriage implode. And she made me so angry, but that's a testament to Gillian Flynn. That's the best review I think I could ever give it on BookReads. I threw this book out the window at speed into my honeymoon in the African scrub. And it was really good. But I just think that, yeah, like the kind of filmmaker that he is and the kind of text that he selects and just this being like the most high art kind of genre film possible makes it so infinitely rewatchable, and people just love it. And it feels like in the last 10 years, any kind of weird tormented relationship, you know, even the Netflix series, it just feels like there's all those, there's a whole stack of copycats and things that are trying to do this movie again. But I think Gillian Flynn's text and Fincher together and these actors, it's almost impossible.
Like, you know, whenever there's a literary hit, there's always going to be like the copycats and the knockoffs, and you know, for every like Devil Wears Prada, there's like Confessions of a Shoplifter or whatever.
I'd like Confessions of a Shoplifter better than Shopaholic, to be honest.
That'd be the darker version.
Yeah.
Get in trouble, maybe. I don't know. But like for this, I remember like the knockoffs were, I'm having just such a, like, I wrote it all down. I don't know where I put it on my notes, but like Girl in the Window, Girl on the Train, Woman in the Window, Girl on the Train. Those were the two big. See, they're blurred together. They're not nearly as good. They don't have that. Like, there's more of a watered down quality with them.
Yeah.
And not that they're like not, they don't have their like highlights in them, but they're just not nearly as, like, it feels like they were constructed for just the knockoff reason versus I want to put high art into the world, or I want to put like, I really want to change, like, I really want to make a statement with this, but the other ones don't really have statements on other things than just the superficial sort of narrative plot going on to them. So those have been like a thing that sort of keeps Gone Girl going throughout the years. And then there was just that case, and it's a documentary, I can't remember the name of it, on Netflix that I watched. It's like a 3-part documentary on the case in California of where it was suspected that the woman was gone girling herself. And she
it's now become an adjective.
Yeah. Heck. They turned it into a verb. And so like the media was saying that, so this girl got kidnapped, held for 48 hours or whatever, and then brought back home, like a blonde white woman. Brought back home. She had all this these tales to tell. And the media and the police here sort of spun it as her faking this. This was a hoax. She came back. Like, there was all these weird things about her story that just were not lining up. And so they put it out there irresponsibly. And it turns out that there was a guy who actually kidnapped her. And it goes into this whole thing. So that also, like, you know, birthed a whole like thing. So Gone Girl is very much in the zeitgeist still. Like, nobody turned Woman in the Window into a thing.
And it will just never, Ben Affleck's shit-eating grin mm-hmm. at his missing wife's face is is still one of the good memes. You know, when someone has an awful take or someone is so totally unhinged, you just put that photo up there on social media as your little response to it, and it's just like it's still there. It's still there. Now, thank you so much for doing this. You're amazing. Thank you for having course. Me. Such a pleasure talking to you about this. Can I ask, do you remember if Gone Girl rated highly in your films of that year? Like, so back in 2014, was it in your top five? Was it your number one? And if now you could, you know, do you have a top five of 2014 that you would could share?
Yeah. Let me bring it up in my notes, because I think so. I actually did write out a top. I did a top 14, I think, of 2014 at the time. And so what it was number five was Selma, four was Nightcrawler, three was Gone Girl. And I had put Blue Ruin. Technically, that was released in 2013.
Yeah.
Or it came out like at film festivals in 2013. Yes. I saw it in 2013, but it was technically released in 2014. So I put it on my 2014 list. I wouldn't do that now, but I would have put it on my 2013 list, because that movie is fantastic. If you've never seen it,
great movie. I've
so good.
Love it.
So
good. Love it.
And the number one was Whiplash. So, but now looking back on that list, just judging by movies that I've gone back to that were on that list, like that I've gone back to over the years, time and time again, my top five would be whatever you want to call this one. Edge of Tomorrow, All You Need Is Kill, Live, Die, Repeat, whatever title you choose to call that Tom Cruise, Emily Blunt. Brilliant, brilliant movie. That would be my number five. My number four would be The Lego Movie, because I've watched that a million times. And I think that's
You're a big animation girly at heart too. Yeah, great movie. Yeah.
And it's so great. And I think that's sort of like, Warner Brothers is constantly trying to find the next Lego movie. And I think that was one of their guiding things that they wanted for Barbie, is they're like, how can you make this a Lego movie?
Yeah.
And they really want the next like sort of like smart thing. And then it would be Nightcrawler.
Will Ferrell's in both, obviously, as well. So if you just have a little sprinkling of Will Ferrell, you can get a little bit closer.
Yeah, that's right. And then it would be Nightcrawler, because I've come back to that a million times.
Great movie.
Also, great movie about power of the media and total psycho sociopath, you know, running the joint. I think my type is sociopaths.
You're a mixture between animation girly and like curating some of the best sociopaths online.
And then it would be Whiplash, which is still so, chilling. It's still hard to watch, but I've watched it a couple of times. Since seeing it
also has that ability in Whiplash of to your point, having dark, obsessed, kind of grating characters in the right environments that become like intoxicating to watch. You can't get enough of J.K. Simmons, even though he's an absolute tyrannical piece of shit, but you love it. You like there's that weird like Stockholm syndrome as a viewer and as Miles Teller's character of like just relishing that. And it's so wonderfully directed. It's a real breakout.
That whole last 15 minutes is just jaw dropping, edge of your seat. You don't even have to like jazz music or understand it to get this, you know, strive for perfection at all costs, like at any sort of like sacrifice. He sacrifices everything. Like, he gets in a car accident on the way there and like comes bloodied to the stage and has to like perform at like a top rate. Like, it's such a, I love it. I think it's so, so great. And then my number one, you know, looking back, would be Gone Girl. Cause again, I've watched it I come back to it at least twice a year and joke with my husband that I'm taking notes, but I just love it from every sort of, you know, standpoint, from a technical mastery, from narratively, from writing, from dialogue to performance. Like, it's all there. That's my sweet spot.
Your sweet spot. I will bring up, you know, you're the first person that has actually asked me what my list is what? So far. Yeah, like just in so far in this year's in this year's decade project, I kind of didn't say Yeah, like, you know, I usually ask the question, but not many people come back and go, well, specifically, what was yours? And I revisited my list because only Lovers Left Alive, technically, I saw it. I was a bit like, it was a 2013 movie, but it was on my 2014 list yes, at the time.
Yes, mine too. Mm-hmm. Good, good one. So good. But,
so on that list, and I'd have to go back and have a look. So I'll kick off Only Lovers Left Alive, and just kind of go like, What We Do in the Shadows by Taika Waititi was probably five. Hilarious, like Vampires in Auckland by way of the Kardashians movie that has now spawned into a sensational show. Mm-hmm. The Wolf of Wall Street. I just loved and adored and blew my socks off. It was probably my favorite movie for the longest part of the year because I saw it and I just had that Max Cady in the cinema in Cape Fear experience where I was just like, like I was just having the best time. But again, that's technically a 2013 movie as well. We got it later. So that one kind of probably needs to go off the list too. I need to do a whole new list. Grand Budapest Hotel, I mm-hmm. adored. Guardians of the Galaxy, I had such a fun time with at the time. But my number one is Calvary, which if you haven't heard of it or you can't place it, it's a John Michael McDonough film starring Brendan Gleeson and Kelly Riley before she jumped into Yellowstone and became massive. And it's about a priest who takes a confession from someone who says that he's got 1 week to live because you're a good priest, but I was abused by a priest, so you're going to die. And he basically has to go through this town, a whole bunch of people, which you could argue are just, impressions or manifestations of the seven deadly sins, to figure out the mystery of who is going to kill him. And I think it is a stone cold masterpiece. One of my favorite movies ever. I love it. It is so great. It's such an excellent movie. If you haven't seen it, watch it. It's so spectacular. Yeah. And the more that I've thought about it in the preceding years, you know, at the time, you know, you can tell in your taste, like I was very popcorn-y. There's a few like art movies there, but I kind of was trying to unashamedly be a popcorn, a popcorn movie lover in that particular year. We were eating well when it came to popcorn movies. But yeah, more and more, if I went back, while a whole bunch of other things would move because of release times and when I saw them in Australia and all the weird baddie stuff that happens sometimes, I would say that Calvary, which was a genuine 2014 release, is absolutely my favorite.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I asked because I did miss that one. I remember that coming out and somehow life happened. And
of course, yeah, it was an easy one to miss. It was more festively than anything else, but man, I love Brendan Gleeson and John Michael McDonough is maybe my favorite McDonough. You know, they did The Guard together and they,
The Guard's,
fantastic. Guard. This is just another one that's special.
Well, I'm glad I asked.
I'm glad you asked too. You're the first one that asked. Usually people are like, okay, Blake just wants to know what I want, but not many people spin it back on me. So I had to think quick. But I have to revitalize my list, knowing exactly what we're covering this year. Because there's a couple of others that I would definitely say deserve to be at the top of that list. Court, is there anything that you want to plug before I let you go?
I don't think so. I think, you know, you can find my writings on Twitter, the wonderful platform, Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it.
We're calling it Twitter.
And, you know, Instagram, I'm on Instagram. I'm also on Threads now, which not very often, but mostly I'm on Twitter. You can find me at Lulu Maybell. And you can find my scribblings on, as Blake said, Variety, the AV Club, freshfiction.tv, you know. There's always movies coming out. There's non-slot.
And I want to say, I'm so happy for you. I know how much you enjoyed Dune Part 2. And right now the internet is really delivering on the memes.
Oh my God.
We are eating right now so well.
Feasting so well.
Feasting. Thank you to both the Dune Part 2 and now the Love Lies Bleeding press tour for just giving us so many great things. But I'll end this by just saying, Courtney, what have we done to each other? What have we done to each other?
What will we do?
What will we do? Thank you so much.
I can't like look up like she looks up on Zoom. I need Fincher here to like
just look up at your husband and you're like, I want to watch Gone Girl again. He's like, no.
That bookend of like, oh, we didn't even talk about the Reznor Ross score, which is so brilliant. Like I listened to that just.
That's a good writing soundtrack. Yeah, absolutely. All of their scores are great. Especially The Social Network. Social Network is the one I think gets most play, but this is quite good too. I think we covered so much. Thank you for doing justice to this. And
I can go on another 3 hours about this. Like, welcome to my TED talk.
I'm just going to leave. I'm getting out of here, and Courtney's going to take over, and we'll be fine. Thank you so much for doing the show. I really appreciate you. We'll find more excuses to talk about other movies in 2014. But thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. It was truly a pleasure. I always love talking to you. So this was great.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.